So what I need to do today is a schematic reading of religion, absolute knowing, and speculative proposition. And schematic in the sense that I will be trying to give you the way in which to read it, and not obviously provide all the details. The details you can find in lots of different places. But I'll give you a framework which I think is distinctive and which will carry on, if it's convincing, from the way in which we concluded the section on spirit and the account of forgiveness. So forgiveness is going to be key to absolute knowing. But in order to do that, I have to first say something about religion, which I'm going to spend a bit of a while on. And those of you who were at the Taylor Fest will already have some indication of what the argument will look like, since really the argument of those 3 days was Taylor wants to insist that the distinction between immanence and transcendence is non-sublatable. And, of course, Hegel's great accomplishment is to deconstruct the distinction or the dualism between immanence and transcendence, to make that idea go dead for us. And that's what I want to try to convince you, that that idea should go dead for us. And once it goes dead, then, well, everything changes. So the transition to religion can make one wonder about what Hegel's commitments are, especially his references to absolute spirit. In his mature system, Hegel distinguishes between subjective spirits, objective spirit, and absolute spirit. And although he doesn't quite have those distinctions operative yet, they are implicit in the phenomenology. Subjective spirit equals roughly the human being as both a natural being, Hegel's idea of the philosophy of mind, including sense, imagination, consciousness, even self-consciousness, and as an individual, hence the a human being as possessing reason. Objective spirit is the human being in and as history. And because history for Hegel is fundamentally political history, or the history of freedom, then it will include his philosophy of history and his political philosophy. Finally, is the notion of absolute spirit. And absolute spirit comes in three forms: religion, art, and philosophy, right? Corresponding roughly, to the good, the beautiful, and the true. And those are the three forms in which we become aware of ourselves. That is, they are each reflective comprehensions of the meaning of objective spirit. That is, they're not separate objects. They're about reflection on the meaning of the fact of our life as historical and political beings. So they do not belong to our life in the world, but they are a systematic representation and comprehension of our being in the world. So spirit becomes conscious. So they are all forms in which spirit becomes aware of itself as spirit. Although that's not what they think they're doing. I'll say a word about that. In the phenomenology, the notion of absolute spirit has not yet been worked out in detail, but what he argues is fairly analogous, namely, spirit, Hegel wants to argue, is absolute if and only if it is unconditioned, and if it's unconditioned, that it is no longer bounded by any external reality. There are no things in themselves outside of it, so there cannot be either things in themselves, or God, or noumenon, or leprechauns, whatever. Everything belongs within the world of spirit, and hence there can no longer be a contrast between the life of spirit and anything else. Or, again, going back to our very first lecture, there cannot be a dualism between world and conceptual scheme. That those two things must be seen as different sides of the same coin. Now, at the very least, it can be argued that historically, say in 1806, the opposition between something that is sheerly transcendent, namely some notion of God, and something utterly immanent, say the life of human beings in history, still lingered, still remained, and therefore Hegel has to work at that remnant thought, since it still burdens consciousness. Now, whether or not we feel that a secular philosophy must be answerable to the claims of religious consciousness will depend on whether we feel there are any religious claims remaining. So Nietzsche, for example, still felt the tug of those claims. He thought about the death of God. It was alive for him. And therefore thought further that the tug of those claims and the tug of the claims of a scientific single truth were the same thing. So he felt rationally required to undo those claims. Now I mention Nietzsche here simply to make the point about answerability, and hence why a philosopher may feel compelled to address religion as such. Hegel's background made the thought of the requirement that a imminent secular philosophy answer those claims feel necessary to him. Furthermore, at least in his case, since his entire philosophy is about all the false forms of consciousness that have been truly formative, educative, for modern self-consciousness, that is, the necessary historical conditions that allowed us to get here, and of course, he has to include an account of religion. Now, the formative character or role of religious consciousness has at least in part been dealt with earlier, namely in the chapter on the unhappy consciousness, for example. We got overcome there when we saw the story of the priest becoming Luther, becoming Descartes, and again in the account of faith and pure insight when we saw those two claims were the same. Hence here, the emphasis... So in those accounts, what Hegel says is what was dealt with was the individual having God as its object, And in those cases, he showed how that object consciousness was sublated. What we have not dealt with, Hegel thinks, is what I'm going to call religion proper. And religion proper turns out to be something then, awareness of the transcendent God. That's what I have to explain. What's the difference between religion proper and awareness of a transcendent God? Further, just to add one more problem to the menu of problems, as Westfall in his book notes on page 187, we still don't have a sufficient account of our relation to nature as a whole. That is, the natural world as such. About the natural world, we know it, or spirit knows it, through natural science. And science, we now know that in science knowing nature, it does not know the absolute. That was the story of observing reason, right? The story of observing reason was trying to claim knowing nature is absolute. We saw that didn't happen. But of course, that was already common knowledge in Hegel's era. That was Kant's great insight. That's Kant's critique of scientism. That whatever, however complete the Newtonian worldview is, it's not self-sufficient. For example, it can't make sense of the fact that you have science, right? So unless you have a wholly naturalized epistemology, et cetera, none of that is going to work. So that leaves the question of nature still hanging. So further, while spirit knows itself as spirit, that's what more or less happens at the end of the chapter on spirit, it does not yet know that this knowledge is self-sufficient, that there's nothing outside of it. So spirit as spirit must come to the knowledge that its knowledge of nature cannot be absolute knowledge, and further, it must come to a recognition of itself as absolute. That is, only spirit's knowledge of spirit can be absolute knowledge. That's where we're heading. Now, from all this, I take it as almost a gimme that when Hegel says that spirit is the I equals we, and the we that is the I, but that's it. He means it. There's nothing else. So the task is to make the claim of religions in their development accord with that claim. That is, to show how the development of religious forms occurs in a way in which that thesis, namely spirit is the I equals we and the we equals I, is the terminus of the development of religion itself, which is roughly what happens in the chapter on religion. That is, there is a movement from natural religion. I'm already running out of room. So there's a movement from natural religion to art religion to manifest or reveal religion. And in revealed religion, what occurs literally is that God becomes man, that man, Jesus, dies and returns as Spirit, the Holy Ghost, equals the congregation of believers, equals the community of conscientious selves. That, in brief, is the argument. Religious knowledge, Hegel says, is self-knowledge that does not know itself to be that. That is, religious knowledge is a form of self-consciousness that mistakes itself about itself. So religion always conceives of God as absolute, which is to say, it always conceives of God as being or substance. So, the path we have followed up to now, we have been tracking the way in which subjective experience, sense certainty, turns out not to have an object it's grounded in, right, but discovers that it is self-grounding. So that subject becomes substance. So the individual subject doesn't know the substance, isn't aware of substance, it becomes aware of itself as the substance of the world, as spirit. Which is why when we began the chapter on spirit, just to remind you, Hegel defined spirit with all the predicates of substance, right? It's unself-sufficient, it's unmoving, it's the ground of our life. He gave us all the same predicates that one usually gives substance. So, that's the discovery we've made thus far. In this chapter, we are, in a sense, starting again, because we have this, I'm now suggesting, lingering problem. We have this awareness of a sphere in which we seem to be aware of substance that doesn't accord fully with this story. So we need to read again, start from the very beginning. Hence Hegel starts with the religions of light, and show how substance, that is, the logical unfolding of the idea of religion, turns out to show that God is not any different than the terminus of the previous story. So as in, say, the history of religion and the history of spirit converge on the very same item, namely ourselves as self-determining historical creatures, as a community of the living and the dead. And that's exactly what Hegel says in paragraph 75. In paragraph 761, he says God is attainable only in pure speculative knowledge. And he is only in that knowledge. And he is simply that knowledge itself, for he is spirit. God's esse is conceptae, right? His essence is his concept. And his concept is, right, just the concept of spirit. Hence, God is only in that knowledge and he is simply that knowledge itself, for he is spirit. Now, I like Westfall's way of making this claim. Religious knowing is a projection, but it is not an illusion. God is a product of human activity, but that does not mean God is a figment of the imagination, as the Enlightenment thought. In cashing out this claim, Westfall follows Durkheim's elementary forms of religious life. And it's not an argument, again, that any serious debate about religion just has to go to Durkheim. This is why Taylor kept saying, I'm a neo-Durkheimian, but neo, right? He kept trying to push Durkheim away. Taylor knows better than anyone that the Durkheimian thesis was first put forward by Hegel, so that what Durkheim and Hegel agree is that religion is neither superstitious belief, nor pseudoscience, nor a package of illusions. There is something deep about religion, and what is deep about it is that it has been, and this is what Nietzsche may make sense of, it has been an essential element of nearly all human social experience, and it has always been conceived of as the foundation of that experience. Indeed, religion has always been, and it says so in the meaning of the word, it has considered the connectedness of human beings. That is, religion has always been the way in which human beings have thought the meaning of the social. So it is a representation, a representation of the ground of all human experience, and hence the old famous dictum, you can tell a people by the gods they keep. That is, the way a people think of God is how they think of themselves, because God is their fundamental self-interpretation. Here's Durkheim. Passage ideally loved from the elementary forms. It's quoted on page 197 in Westfall. Religion ceases to be an inexplicable hallucination and takes a foothold in reality. In fact, we can say that the believer is not deceived when he believes in the existence, this is the great phrase, when he believes in the existence of a moral power upon which he depends and from which he receives all that is best in him. This power exists. It is society. It is true that he is wrong in thinking that this increase of vitality is the work of a power in the form of some animal or plant, but this error is merely in regard to the letter of the symbol by which this being is represented, and not in regard to the fact of its existence. Not false in regard to its existence. I should remind you that Marx said that the ontological proof of God's existence is true. Same thought. Behind these figures and metaphors, be they gross or refined, there is a concrete and living reality. Thus, religion is a system of ideas with which individuals represent to themselves the society of which they are members and the obscure but intimate relations which they have with it. Let's simply call this the Durkheim hypothesis. Given what I said about the structure of the chapter on religion, we can now say that the process through which finite spirit becomes the process is one in which finite spirit becomes more and more aware of its identity with absolute spirit. That is, the distance between the sacred and the profane becomes smaller and smaller, and there is a continuing work of making the transcendent imminent. And saying all this is equal to saying that as the concept of the whole evolves, and that's what substance is, our concept of the whole. So the history of religion is the history of the evolution of our thinking about the meaning of the whole. And Hegel takes the history of religion deeply seriously. As this evolves and the community becomes more and more aware about its absolute role and status in that concept. So let's say that the notion of congregation becomes more and more emphatic, so that the content of the absolute and the being of a certain type of community become almost identical. Nonetheless, as long as we think that absolute spirit is causing that advance in some independent way, right, and that's what the Pope thinks, we have not reached the absolute concept of it. What we need to discover is that the movement of God in the world is our self-movement. From this it follows that the chapter on religion should not be read as is sometimes claimed, the logical biography of the absolute spirit in its otherness. That's the religious reading of Hegel. But rather, it should be read as the community's recollection and repossession of its experience of itself qua community, qua spirit. So it is a continual probing and attempt to come to grips with who we are and how we are to orient ourselves in the world given who we are. And this is because spirit cannot subsist at all in simple otherness. Again, religious knowledge is spirit's self-knowledge that does not know itself to be that. And there are, I should say, crazy pneumatological ways of reading that. So Whitehead, in Process and Reality, has this idea that God needs man in order to know himself. So he deposits himself, and then he gathers himself back up through human history. Right? So these are the ways, which, you know, is kind of fabulous. And this is what people have to do in order to try to make sense of Hegel and try to hold on to some crazy notion of transcendence. But it's that crazy, I think. Well, how does religion fail to know itself? Seems a good question. And Hegel's answer over and over again is that religion fails to know itself because religious knowing is picture thinking or representation. So the crux of the matter for Hegel is, so one of the things we may think about the whole of the phenomenology is it's a critique of representational thought. And I'll say more about that as we go on. And then we have to figure out what is representational thought and why are they saying such nasty things about it. But at any rate, and that's going to be the ultimate stakes in the shift from religion to absolute knowing. The shift is going to be from representational thinking to conceptual thinking. Right? Those are Hegel's ways of describing the difference, what's at stake here. And I'll have to convince you that there's a way of thinking about conceptual thinking that is not the same as representational thinking. And that turns out to be a bit tricky, but doable. So I think. Okay, let me skip the history of religion. Or at least skip it right down to the emergence of Christianity. Here's the puzzle that every reader of Hegel has. The section on art religion is really the history of Greek religious thought. And Greek religious thought, as we know, starts out by picturing the gods looking pretty much like you and me, only with little extra powers. And they behave badly like we do, and so on and so forth. And then the history of Greek thought really devolves until finally, in Greek comedy, as it were, it looks like the game is over. That is, there is no difference between God and man. That's Aristophanes' kind of endless comic point. The actor is just like ourselves, and God becomes man, full stop, end of religion. Well, if religion died in ancient Greece, why do we have another 100 pages or so to go? And why do we need Christianity? What went wrong there, and what's the extra content in Christianity that didn't come out of, let's call it, Greek humanism? That became Roman humanism. Put it another way, we already, as Westerners, already achieved a fully secular world at the end of the Hellenic era, and that got transmitted in various forms into the Roman world unsteadily, but it did, hence the great Roman philosophies that have so influenced us, like Stoicism. Why do we need another story? What's missing? And doesn't the fact, one could argue, that Hegel turns back to Christianity show that he's really a theist after all? That's the real word. Well, Stern, in his commentary, seems to me to state the issue nicely. In the chapter on religion, what we see happening is the thought that absolute being is substance, and via the unfolding of natural religion and art religion, we actually do see the claim emerge that the self is absolute being, which gives priority to humanity as having the kind of subjectivity that God was seen to lack. Well, what's wrong with the thesis, the self is absolute being? Let's call the thesis, the self is absolute being, the secularization hypothesis. Man, God becomes man. The problem with it is that the substance of religion itself disappears. That is, the claim is there is a content to religion and to religious thought that the secularization hypothesis, in the form in which it comes down to us in Greek humanism, belies. Well, this can take a lot of different forms. One of which is the crazy form, and the one that even Stern seems to suggest is the crazy form I just suggested, namely God achieving self-consciousness through humanity. Right? And the idea of God achieving self-consciousness through humanity, you may say, balances the idea of transcendence with the idea of immanence. But that idea, I think, is question-begging, since it still leaves ambiguous what the word God is doing here. Therefore, I think Hegel's thought is that there is an excess to religion, and the excess to religion that is not thought in the Greek humanism is exactly the Durkheim hypothesis. Namely that we are absolutely dependent on a moral power from which we receive all that is best in us. Namely, our society, which is both free and self-determining, and simultaneously a community of the living and the dead. So I construe the account of manifest religion as the attempt to reveal, first, the need or necessity for seeking out that excess, generally, and then to show that correctly understood, that the correct interpretation of Christianity is its own implicit announcement and vindication of the Durkheim hypothesis. That is, Hegel really thinks that Christianity did everything but become a sociological account of itself. It couldn't have done more and remained a religion. It announced the Durkheim hypothesis itself. It just didn't quite recognize that it had done so. And the reason why, again, is that in religion the recognition remains only implicit because, qua religion, it remains bound to picture thinking. Hence, to comprehend religion philosophically is to make explicit religion's implicit self-recognition, and hence to pass beyond the picture thinking that keeps it back. So to overcome religion is a matter of making the implicit explicit, and it is to translate religious thought into conceptual forms. So what I want to do in the next 25 minutes or so is say something about that. That is, the need for an excess, Christianity's own recognition of the Durkheim hypothesis, and then say something about picture thinking. In paragraph 750, Hegel argues that previously we saw that the advance from Sittlichkeit, that is the Greek polis, to the abstract legal person of Roman law. Okay?
Movement from classical Greece to the emergence of the Roman legal person.
That's the same transition as the transition from, that he is making here, from the end of Greek religion to the emergence of Christianity, is another version, a different version of that story. So the individual of comedy, we know, becomes the Roman legal person. That's the fate of that comic individual. Now the problem is this. The formal recognition of the person as having rights lacks the substance of the Greek polis. So the problem of the polis what the whole deal about Antigone was all about, right, is that it was community without individuality. Right? Poor Antigone was trapped in her role, right? And that in order to solve the problem of the reduction of the self to its role, it had to be free from its natural determination. So we needed an account of individuals that was non-natural, hence the notion of the Roman legal person. So we move out of this notion, this ideal notion of community, and are going to move to Roman right. But the notion of Roman right is individuality without community. And it is therefore not an accident that Rome could only think the notion of community in the notion of the emperor, another individual, right? It could not, as it were, wrap its mind having the notion of right going. It never could really think of Rome in other than individualistic terms. Now, what Hegel says here is this, that in this movement, from community without individuality to individuality without community, he says the reality of the ethical spirit of Sittlichkeit is lost. Reality of Sittlichkeit is lost, entailing nihilism and disenchantment, even the unhappy consciousness. And he tells roughly that story in paragraphs 751 through 753. Now, I can't underline enough the phrase, the reality of the ethical spirit is lost, since it is exactly that which Hegel sees as the task of Christianity. It must restore the reality of ethical spirit. So that the difficulty, right? So this is how the two sides of Western history, the kind of Greco-Roman side and the Christian side, really require one another.
For out of the Greco-Roman side, we get the strong conception of individuality and of rights
and of republicanism, all of which are fundamental.
But those ideas, Hegel thinks, are done in a nihilistic vein because they do not have an adequate conception of community.
And we saw that they lacked an adequate sense of community
in the French Terror.
That's exactly what they led to when not buoyed by their Christian other. So it's not an accident that Hegel thinks that Christianity has a role to play in the formation of an adequate secular humanism. Now, in order for this to happen, religion must unfold internally, so to speak, that is, of its own accord, in such a way that absolute being itself takes itself
to recognize that substance is subject.
That is,
Hegel thinks that there must be an internal logic of religious development in which religion's own self-rationalization, that is, its own account of rationalizing its own beliefs internally, for which you can read about the 20-odd volumes of Max Weber. That's all he wrote about. That was his theory of everything, namely how religious rationalization is Western rationalization. And Hegel doesn't disagree with that thought. How religion refines itself to recognize that substance is subject. So, and why that matters, right, is exactly because it cannot come out of a wholly external criticism. That is, religion cannot, as it were, disappear because people outside of it think it's incoherent, that is, superstition. It has to be part of its own logical unfolding that, as Nietzsche would put it, our highest values devalue themselves, that is, transvalue themselves into something else. So, step two in the argument, Hegel has to then unlock the spiritual and ethical content of Christianity. And we kind of know in a dumb schematic way, I've already suggested, it's going to be God the Father equals the universal. God the Son is going to be the particular, and that the Holy Spirit is going to be the synthesis of those two. So, for Hegel, the crucial elements of the Christian story, the incarnation of God self dispossessing himself of his universality and depositing himself in the world in a living and mortal being who will suffer and die on the cross, and that there be a death and a resurrection, and that resurrection will be, right, after ascending back and returning as the Holy Spirit.
That logic, Hegel thinks, unpacks into the whole imminence of subject becoming collective subject, spirit. We can dig out this structure in Hegel's interpretive program by looking at, I just want to look at a few passages, paragraphs 780 to 784 is where most of the fascinating stuff happens, or where the whole passage of real religion I find thrilling. But I wouldn't use me as a Geiger counter for thrillingness. So what he's going to do in these paragraphs, among other things, is deny the fall, posit an overcoming of good and evil, and claim that that overcoming of good and evil recalls explicitly the relationship between judging and acting consciousness. So paragraph 780, which is an endless paragraph, and it's about halfway through on page 472, he says, in the pictured form, there is depicted the reconciliation of the divine being with its other, in general, and specifically with the thought of it, evil. If this reconciliation is notionally expressed by saying that it consists in the fact that evil is in itself the same as goodness, or again, that the divine being is the same as nature, so let's be clear that, so let's get the equivalence that this is going to be judging consciousness, of course, by now, and this is supposed to be good, and this is going to be acting consciousness. So Christ and Antigone are the same, and they're evil, and evil equals nature as a whole. Well, what else is the fall? I mean, that's what it is to deny that you have to go to heaven after. But there's supposed to be, right, the day of judgment where all this is gathered back up and made good. Hence, Hegel taking this story very literally. If this reconciliation is notionally blah, 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 the same as nature in its whole extent, or that nature separated from the divine being is simply nothing, we must regard this as an unspiritual way of talking, and one that is necessarily bound to give rise to misunderstanding. If evil is the same as goodness, then evil is just not evil, nor goodness good. On the contrary, both are suspended moments. Evil in general is self-centered being for self, and goodness is what is simple and without a self. That's the translation into judging and acting consciousness. When thus expressed in terms of their notion, their unity is at once evident. It goes on in obvious ways. So that this way of taking the burden out of the fall, right? And this argument carries through to paragraph 784, where we actually find Hegel hammering home his version of the Durkheim hypothesis. So, right at the beginning of paragraph 784, he says, the knowledge of nature as the untrue existence of spirit and this imminently developed universality of the self is in itself the reconciliation of spirit with itself. And then dropping down several sentences, the death of the divine man as death is abstract negativity, the immediate result of the movement which ends only in natural universality. Death loses this natural meaning in spiritual self-consciousness, that is, it comes to be its just stated notion. Death becomes transfigured from its immediate meaning, namely the non-being of this particular individual, into the universality of the spirit which dwells in his community, dies in it every day, and is daily resurrected. So, Hegel's claim here is that Christianity, understood in, very quickly now in this way, leads to the idea that the coming into existence of God's individual self-consciousness as a universal self-consciousness is the same as religious community. So when Hegel claims that God the Father and God the Son are abstract moments, neither are actual until the emergence of spiritual community, he's thus claiming that religion is seeking the thought, that community is, againly, the truth of those two moments. Right? So this notion of Holy Spirit is that something about religious thought needed to make those internal developments in order to be coherent for itself. Essentially, then, Hegel is arguing that the divine being is a form akin to judging consciousness, that the Christ is akin to acting consciousness, and that the mutual recognition between them is, his phrase now, intuitively apprehended by religious consciousness as the coming of the Holy Spirit, which in fact is what Hegel says explicitly in paragraph 786. In paragraph 787, although there is a return out of picture thinking in principle in communal self-recognition, Hegel goes on to say that the community is not yet perfected in this its self-consciousness, and that picture thinking still burdens communal spirituality because it is yet to achieve pure thought. About this, Hegel is emphatic. He says the community does not possess the consciousness of what it is. Substance has here succeeded in becoming absolute self-consciousness, but this remains an other for devotional consciousness. So Christian consciousness is simply literally confused about its own fundamental commitments. And it's confused not in the sense of having contradictory beliefs, but confused because it expresses those beliefs in a representational way. And the crux of that representational way it is sometimes said by people like Steve Holgate, that the content of religion and the content of Christian religion and the content of Hegelian philosophy are the same, but simply expressed differently. And I am resisting that, and I'm resisting it because the idea that
religious expression of it is true except for its form, namely representational form, rather than conceptual form. That's the argument. Same content, different form, one representational, the other conceptual, is an utterly anti-Hegelian claim, because it assumes that we can have same content, different form. That the content is indifferent to its form, and it can be expressed in this way, and expressed in that way, and it just doesn't matter. But of course, Hegel's thought is exactly the opposite. That what matters most of all is that you can't get the content right until you've got, as it were, the form right. And hence the drive here. So form cannot be mere form for Hegel. That's his critique of Kant over and over again. And we're going to see it's his critique of Kant in Absolute Knowing. So what makes picture thinking, and what's the problem? What picture thinking does is to think the reconciliations that Hegel is claiming are implicitly already there as existing in some beyond. And the notion of beyond becomes, in Christianity, simply the future. That is, what we Christians know is, in some indefinite future, on the day of judgment, right, we will, you know, all be resurrected, body and soul. We will be returned, and, you know, we will be united, finally, with God. So the actual world for the Christian believer, and hence, of course, all the crazy forms, right, of Americans, right? Because American religion is all about, you know, getting redemption now, right? So all that rapture stuff, you know, they just can't wait for the day of judgment to happen when they can, you know, ascend, you know, drinking a malt shake right there at Wendy's, and then zap off, right? And they never say, you know, I know the cars get left behind, but they never say anything about the milkshake. Stay or go. There's a drop to the... I spent 3 years in Tennessee. Scary stuff. Okay. But the thought here is, the problem then is going to be the notion of beyond as the notion of future. So the world still awaits transfiguration. But insofar as it still awaits transfiguration, right, it still does not have the shape of spirit. It still is inwardly disrupted. So what makes picture thinking inadequate is its temporal schema, its idea of a discrete past, present, and future. And hence the idea of, borrowing a phrase from Michael Murray, the idea of the Christian time design, in which God's selfhood is a past event and reconciliation occurs in a distant future, and the present is lost somewhere between manifestation and reconciliation, right? So Christianity is actually structured by a really very traditional idea of the present as a moment of lostness between, of course, you know, you can think of it as Eden and Eden 2 or manifestation and reconciliation. So, and here's the hypothesis I'm going to follow after the break, namely what makes representational thought representational is just temporal understanding,
and therefore to get past representational thought and become conceptual, what we require is a different way of thinking about time. Okay, let's have a quick break there. Since I've said a lot very quickly, and a deep breath is necessary, and we will then carry on.